enjoy the ride. Yeah.
And now more Operation Freedom. With your host, Dr. Dave Janda, on Southeast Michigan's conservative powerhouse, Wham! Talk 1600.
Welcome back to Operation Freedom, folks. I'm Dr. Dave Janda, broadcasting from our Freedom Bunker at Wham! Talk 1600, here every Sunday for you from 2 to 5 Eastern. Also available 24-7 on our YouTube channel, also named Operation Freedom, like the radio show. On our new dailymotion.com/Operation Freedom channel, another video channel that we're uploading because, well, there's been some censorship stuff going on YouTube. And three, we're also available at davejanda.com, both the free, the public side, as well as the subscription side. We'll help you become a member of our Freedom family. I'm honored to have back with me someone I consider a dear friend and someone who is an incredibly courageous individual. One of the hearts that the deep state, the globalist syndicate, whatever you want to use, utilizes to feather their ever-increasing nests of money is their laundering operations of money. And my next guest has taken them on in true hand-to-hand combat. His name is Bob Mazur. He's also known as the, well, the book was written called The Infiltrator, about Bob's life, as was the movie, which starred Bryan Cranston. A little background on Bob. Bob Mazur has earned a global acclaim as one of the world's leading experts on the financial escapades of the underworld. There is no one with more firsthand knowledge about how international banks and businesses cater to those who own the nearly $2 trillion in criminal proceeds laundered annually. For years, in the eyes of organized crime leaders, Bob was a highly successful mob-connected money launderer and helped manage their illicit fortunes. His clients, some of the most famous and deadly drug cartel bosses, offered $500,000 price tag for his head when arrests were made around the world and he was revealed to be a highly trained U.S. federal undercover agent. Bob is the author of The Infiltrator, a memoir about his undercover life, much of which was spent acting as a conduit between ruthless drug barons and corrupt, legitimate-appearing senior executives that cleaned billions in blood-stained money through their otherwise respectable international banks and businesses. Bob has transformed his underworld experience and current-day involvement in the money laundering field into a remarkable lesson for today's business sector. After completing a highly decorated 27-year career as a federal agent in three U.S. agencies, Bob is now the president of KYC Solutions Incorporated, a firm that provides speaking expert witness and consulting services to companies worldwide. Bob's book, and I encourage you to get it if you haven't already, The Infiltrator, is now available in 10 languages and in more than 50 countries and is the basis for the internationally released major motion picture by the same name starring, as I mentioned earlier, Bryan Cranston, Diane Kruger, and other internationally known cast members. More information about Bob Mazur, his book, and the film based on his life can be found at Robert Mazur, M-A-Z-U-R, robertmazur.com. Bob, welcome back to Operation Freedom.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
So, Bob, I have a couple listener questions, if you're willing to go with them. They contacted me saying the next time Bob Mazur comes on, could you please ask a couple quick questions? Would you mind if I pose these to you?
No problem at all.
Okay. The first is from Catherine, and it was like, here it is. Mr. Mazur, every day must have been stressful dealing with the cartel and those in which you encountered. What day and what event made you the most concerned for your own life and welfare?
That came at a time I had just come back from Europe. I'd met there with Pablo Escobar's principal attorney and some other members of the cartel. And I was there for the purposes of showing them the methodologies we would use to establish a $100 million nest egg in Europe for them if they needed to go on the run. And I got the job. So we then needed to pick up money on the streets in the United States, one city being New York, and we were getting $1 million to $2 million a day. I realized that there are many moving parts to the government and its investigations, but I was not too crazy about the idea that there was going to be intense surveillance that was going to be conducted of the people dropping off the money to us. Despite my objections, that occurred, and sometimes the government doesn't give people the benefit of knowing or the benefit by saying to themselves, you know, these guys are smarter than us. And so they were. They had counter-surveillance out there. They picked out every single surveillance officer and then Gerardo Moncada, one of the most vicious members of the Medellin cartel called my partner, saying that it was clear that I had to be a DEA undercover agent because the surveillances were out there. And then after that, I met with, late in the night, one-on-one, with one of Moncada's right-hand guys, and was able to talk him into believing that there was no problem coming from my organization, but we needed to work together to try to figure out why those people were there, so we should stop doing business until we figure that out. And luckily, they went along with it.
So, Bob, how do you convince a killer that you're not the person who turned him in? That had to be like, what did you say?
Well, I was blessed with the opportunity to be trained by a lot of former long-term undercover agents, including somebody who's become a very close friend of mine by the name of Joe Pistone, that the book and the movie Donnie Brasco is based on. And and the theme from him and from others was always, you know, don't act like a cop. The first thing that pops into your mind like a cop in that kind of a scenario might be to turn around and accuse the others of being the ones who created the problem. My thinking as a bad guy would be, oh my God, we've got to figure out how this happened. We got to stop doing everything that we're doing as we did before. And once we find out what it was, and this is exactly what I said to him, I said, listen, if we work together and we figure this out, if you're right and there is a problem on my side, I give you my word, I will see that it is eliminated. But you need to give me the same promise on your side. And it was more like trying to draw a partnership than it was to try to get chesty and accuse people, and I guess it worked. I'm still here.
Well, let's talk about that. So, and Bob, you've told this story before, but it bears repeating because these are the people you were dealing with. The two guys that you had been dealing with that Pablo Escobar thought was screwing him as far as taking some money off the top and not telling him about, right? He had those two dudes that you were dealing with that were messing with Pablo's money brought to him, I believe, while he was still in some people call prison, but it was kind of like his own castle. Educate our listeners about, like, what kind of treatment those folks got. That's what you were facing.
Yeah, you know, there are varying comments made about exactly what happened, but one source that I know that was there who conveyed this, I think there's reason to believe, and that is that after 2 years, 2 years, 2 days of pretty much torturing them, they ultimately hung them by their feet. They stripped their clothes off, and then they used blow torches to melt the skin off their bodies. And then they chopped them up in little pieces, and nobody's ever found them since. So that was a typical day in the neighborhood for them.
Adam asks a question here. Bob, what piece or pieces of technology from 2020 would you have liked to have when you were actually taking on Pablo Escobar and the Medellin drug cartel?
Oh, I'll tell you, the recording devices that are out there now are just so, so sophisticated. You can buy what looks like a pen, works like a pen, and I think you can probably buy it for about $75, and you can record video record from that pen in your pocket for 4 hours. When I was doing this, they used oftentimes a recorder called a Nagra, which became somewhat famous in Hollywood because it is really a fantastic quality recorder, but it's about the size of two packs of cigarettes taped together. And to conceal that, either in the briefcase or on your body, is a major challenge. So, you know, the technology as far as recording is concerned certainly is one. And then there are other technologies now where, you know, if you own a cell phone and people want to find you, I guarantee you, in short order, they'll be right outside your door. So a lot of that type of technology would have made a big difference.
Let's talk about some recent developments, if we could, Bob. There was recently this 4,309-foot-long tunnel in San Diego that was discovered that obviously was used by the cartels. We've had a number of, well, we had El Chapo Guzman escape, I believe, at least once, maybe more than that. We've had these escapes of these individuals, and there appears to be some coordination potentially with a number of political figures based on these escapes and if you will, these high-profile drug traffickers getting, if you will, a slap on the wrist, if at all that. Your take, Bob, on some of the recent developments.
Sure. Well, I'll take the first one first. You know, there has been quotes in the papers about the discussions that Sean Penn had with El Chapo Guzman, and probably the only thing that I can think of that El Chapo Guzman was honest about was his comment that whatever happens to me, this will never end. And I think that that's true. You know, he got all kinds of credit for the sophistication of tunnel building, but long after he was in prison, and as he said, whatever happens to me, this will never end. Now we have the discovery just 10 days ago of the longest tunnel between Mexico and the U.S. that's ever been discovered. It was 4,309 feet long. That's more than three-quarters of a mile, and it ran from an industrial area in Tijuana to a warehouse district in San Diego. The tunnel itself was 5.5 feet tall, 2 feet wide, 70 feet below the surface. It had an elevator at its entrance and a rail and cart system to export drugs to the U.S. and import money back to Mexico from the U.S., and a forced air ventilation system, high-voltage electrical cables, and a complex drain system. This tunnel was found by Mexican authorities long after El Chapo was extradited to the U.S., and this is why many people familiar with the weaknesses at our border have tried to help people to understand that a secure border requires a combination of technologies. There is a wall in San Diego that runs right over this massive tunnel that's 70 feet below. So, you know, we really have to rely, I think, heavily on the border security experts to develop a strategy about what can best be done. You know, it's not as simple as any one thing, and it definitely does require more technology than simply building a structure that you hope people won't be able to go around. You know, and as far as these cartel guys, you know, this, I think, is one of the most interesting events that I've seen in the recent past. And that is three prisoners that were being extradited to the United States escaped from a Mexican jail in the very recent past. The big question is who, how, when, and why. Mm-hmm. So the who is that, okay, there are three guys, but the most important one who was there is a guy by the name of Victor Beltran. They called him El Vic. Who was he? He was the chief financial officer, the CFO for the Sinaloa cartel, and a consigliere to Guzman. The big how they did that, he's the big fish. How they did that, Beltran and these two other cartel members were being held nice and securely at a major high security facility in Mexico, but a judge issued an order having them removed to a local Mexican city jail.
Oh, nice.
And even so, they had to get past five locked doors, security doors, and they were transported by guards to a local hospital, and now they've disappeared. Clearly, it was an inside job. Yes, there's an investigation targeting the deputy prison director, the director of security, and about 16 people on the staff. But now the question is, what's the significance of when this happened? And this happened after corruption allegations were revealed through the trial of El Chapo. The corruption allegations included details about huge payments to key government officials, including past Mexican presidents and the current president of Mexico, along with high-ranking officials. Details about these payments are definitely known by Mr. Beltran, one of the men who has now disappeared. Beltran would know about a guy by the name of Genaro Garcia Luna, who was arrested in Dallas 2 months ago on U.S. federal charges. He's the former Mexican Secretary of Public Safety and the architect of Mexico's war on drugs. He oversaw the creation of Mexico's federal police. His U.S. indictment alleges he received millions in bribes from the Sinaloa cartel for protection. He also is accused of directing security forces to concentrate efforts against rivals of the Sinaloa cartel. And there was detailed testimony in the El Chapo Guzman trial about cartel bagmen twice delivering briefcases containing millions to Garcia Luna. One of the star witnesses against El Chapo, Jesus Zambada, testified that he personally made at least $6 million in cash payments to Garcia Luna and that the Sinaloa cartel maintained a $50 million bribe fund for Garcia Luna. In 2012, Garcia Luna moved to Texas, where he had amassed a personal fortune, and that's a key reason why it was pretty easy for us to grab him. There was additional corruption-related testimony in the El Chapo trial by Zambada and he, about the fact that he paid millions in bribes to a guy by the name of Humberto Eduardo Antima Miranda, who led the defense ministry under President Felipe Calderon. There was other testimony from a guy by the name of Alex Cifuentes. He's a Colombian trafficker that served as El Chapo's secretary and aide, who testified against El Chapo. He provided details about an alleged $100 million bribe paid to Enrique Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, during the period of 2012 to 2018. That payment was allegedly made because Peña, before declaring his candidacy, contacted Guzman and sent the message that in exchange for $250 million, a mere quarter of a billion, El Chapo didn't need to stay in hiding. And according to Cifuentes, the amount of the bribe was negotiated down to $100 million. According to Cifuentes, El Chapo authorized payments between $10 and $12 million to Mexican military units to either kill or capture his rivals. There was a U.S. government motion in the trial that disclosed that there was allegedly a bribe paid to the present president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The bribes were supposedly paid through a senior advisor during López's unsuccessful 2006 presidential campaign. Then we had two witnesses that the first Mexican official bought by El Chapo was Guillermo González Calderoni, the chief of Mexico City's federal police. Calderoni furnished El Chapo daily information, including a tip that the U.S. had built the radar installation to track shipments from Colombia. Calderoni's alleged corruption is particularly saddening because he became a hero in Mexico for helping U.S. authorities crack the case of the kidnapping, torture, and murder of DEA Special Agent Enrique Kiki Camarena. But Calderoni met his demise in 2003 in McAllen, Texas. Sitting in his car and somebody popped a shot in his head. So, you know, we've addressed the who, the how, and the when, but now the big question, why? Why is Beltran, El Vic, why is he now missing? What witness in the cartel leadership could confirm with more than just testimony the payment of bribes, other than the CFO of the Sinaloa cartel and the major money launderer? When I dealt with the Medellin cartel, I can tell you what they did. They recorded their meetings that they had passing bribery, and they kept those tapes so that they could keep people under control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sad fact is this type of outrageous corruption has occurred in Mexico and globally for decades. And I saw it firsthand when a guy by the name of Roberto Alcaino, who I dealt with in the Medellin cartel, told me stories about how they were bringing commercial airlines into military bases in Mexico where the military would unload and then offer free guards and passage for the drugs to then move on into the United States. But, you know, out of this entire thing, there's really, in my view, there's nothing more important concerning these issues than to take particular note of an American hero who sacrificed his life in this war. And whatever I might have done pales in comparison to the tremendous achievements and bravery of one man, Enrique Kiki Camarena,
mm-hmm.
a man who made the supreme sacrifice because of the evil fostered by corruption. You know, people need to know about Kiki Camarena.
Mm-hmm.
He was a DEA agent assigned at the time of his death in Guadalajara, Mexico. He worked his way through college. He was a Marine. He was a fireman. He was a local police officer. And then he became a DEA agent. And when he was murdered, he was 37 years old. He had 11 years on the job at DEA. He was married with three kids. And his mother expressed concern about his becoming a DEA agent, and what Kiki said was, I can't not do this. I'm only one person, but I want to make a difference. And Kiki, among many other things, did undercover work in Mexico and gathered information that led to locating a 220-acre marijuana plantation. The crop on there was worth $160 million to the cartel, and it was all destroyed as a result of his work. So leaders of the cartel, including a guy by the name of Rafael Caro Cantero, a drug lord that had accumulated a net worth of $1 billion in the early 80s. After the plantation was destroyed, he wanted to know as much as he could, and so he ordered the kidnapping. Almost 35 years ago to this day, on February 7, 1985, Kiki left the Guadalajara consulate to meet his wife for lunch. He was confronted by five people, including one who identified himself as a Mexican police officer. He was kidnapped and taken to a remote farm controlled by the cartel, tortured and questioned for 2 days. A doctor was there giving him injections, keeping him awake. And after 2 days, he was killed from a blow to the head with a blunt instrument. He was then buried in a steel-barred chamber behind one of Caro Quintero's mansions, where Kiki his remains were recovered. DEA did whatever they could to help him, to try to find him. Other agencies helped when I was in customs at the time, and our commissioner, Bun Rob, shut the border down, said, I'm not opening up until we get Kiki Camarena back. But in February of 1985, U.S. authorities and Mexican police spotted Rafael Caro Quintero surrounded by five machine gun-toting bodyguards. He was strutting toward a private jet on the Guadalajara airport tarmac. Caro Quintero beckoned the Mexican police commander, minding the DEA agents. The guy came over. He whispered in his ear a $270,000 promise, hugged the commander, turned to the DEA agents, said, my children, next time bring better weapons, not little toys. He laughed, got on the plane, and flew to Costa Rica. And I know one of the Costa Rican officers that helped track him down and take him into custody in Costa Rica. My friend was surprised that the order came to send Caro back to Mexico rather than simply kill him. So Mexico wanted Caro Quintero badly and charged him in Mexico for reasons that later became apparent. They didn't want to allow the U.S. to extradite him. He was convicted in Mexico, and he was put in a prison that was designed for 250 inmates, he and one of his friends. In that prison, they installed kitchens, a living room, a dining room, offices, marble bathrooms, and a carpeted master bedroom with satin sheets. He had closets full of silk shirts, cowboy boots and hats. Women and children came, had radios, telephones, guns, anything he wanted. And he later was let go from prison 8 months after Peña Nieto took office as president. The question becomes, why was he allowed on a technicality, and nobody ever was told that this was going to happen? The U.S. now has a $20 million bounty on his head. Nobody knows where he is. Corruption is the kryptonite of all of this. It's why we can't win this war. It's one of the main reasons why we can't win this war.
Bob, how can folks follow you? They need to follow you.
Just go to robertmazur.com, and you'll find my website. You can send me messages through there. And all I can say is to my brothers and sisters out there in law enforcement, keep fighting the good fight. We're not forgetting about you, and we're going to support you forever.
Bob, thanks for everything you have done, are doing, and will do. Until next time, this is Dave Janda signing off. Dream big and dare to fail. Thanks for joining us today.